When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Welcome, everyone, to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we explore the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comicdom. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, half of your recommended hosting requirement. The other half is provided, as always, by the one and only Brian K. Reese. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Paul. It's good to be a half.
Today on the program, we'll be talking about the acclaimed series Scout by Jason Aaron and R.M. Guerra, published by Vertigo. R.M. Guerra, of course, is another in a long list of names I have probably mispronounced. I believe our listeners are just going to have to get used to that. But first, let's talk about a few things that have been happening in the world of comics. One thing that struck me is the recent announcement of the launch of a new series by DC featuring a new superhero team called the Terrifics.
Terrific!
Yes, this will be written by Jeff Lemire with art by...
They're almost fantastic.
Wait for it.
Wait for it.
It's written by Jeff Lemire and art by Ivan Reyes?
Reyes.
Anyway, the team will be led by Mr. Terrific with Phantom Girl, an invisible woman, Metamorpho, described as an unstoppable force of nature, and Plastic Man who stretches.
So my question, fantastic.
Doesn't it, though? My question to you, Brian, is DC just trolling Marvel now?
Oh, absolutely, they're trolling. I mean, and what a great troll. I mean, this is a fantastic, pardon the pun, troll.
Yeah. It's terrific.
Word other than fantastic at this point, because I think we made our point. But wow, how great is that? Besides the fact that they're using existing characters, putting them as a team, and some of these characters that they're using, Marvel ripped off from them back in the day. And now they're putting them together as a team that is vaguely reminiscent of another team that Marvel made their bones on.
Yeah, well, Marvel's, you know, not using the Fantastic Four out of spite.
Right.
Which is stupid. I mean, all right, an argument could be made that Fantastic Four didn't sell very well. And that is true. And they were only...
It depends on who was doing the run.
Yeah, but in general, in the last decade or so, even Hickman's run was not selling well. Even though it was critically acclaimed and it was lauded and all that, but right, it still wasn't selling well. So an argument could be made, hey, this isn't selling well, and the only reason we are keeping it around is because it's the foundation of the company, but which is why, I mean, I have a personal bias. It's one of my favorite comic book teams, and I grew up reading them. So I like to just have them around because, you know, so they're almost like comfort food. That all being said, the fact that they're not publishing them has nothing really to do with sales. It has to do with the fact that Fox owns the rights and Marvel's just being spiteful.
Right. This is an Ike Perlmutter thing.
Exactly. And if they could do that with X-Men, they probably would.
Right.
Which is why we're getting the Inhumans shoved down our throats.
Right. Well, the point of the Inhumans is to negate the X-Men. And my God,
yeah.
I mean, Marvel has gone out of their way to try to, like, pimp the Inhumans to a fan base that is not interested in the Inhumans.
No. No matter how many times we're told that we should care about the Inhumans, they're just not that great.
Now, they're great characters. They're great secondary characters. I mean, the Inhumans have been an important part of the Marvel Universe for a long period of time.
Starting in the Fantastic Four.
Right. But the Inhumans are not the lead in the Marvel Universe.
No, they are not. And there's nothing... I actually enjoy the Inhuman royal family. Those main, you know, the main characters. Your Black Bolts and Medusas and whatnot. But they are not something you build a franchise around.
Right. I mean, there's some similarities. If the Inhumans are like the substitution for mutants, that's one thing. But if the humans are substitutions for the Fantastic Four, that doesn't work. Other than the fact that Reed Richards is a dick to his wife and Black Bolt is a dick to his wife. Beyond that, yeah.
Well, Reed Richards being a nice guy is a bit of a stretch.
Oh.
I'll be here all week.
Thank you.
Yes. So back to the Terrifics, though. I guess... Yes, it is. It is funny what they're doing. It's a great joke. But can it work as an actual ongoing series?
Well, I mean, that's the big question. Jeff Lemire has written some amazing stuff in indie comics.
Yeah, but his superhero stuff is sort of...
But his superhero stuff is always sketchy, right?
Yes.
But this is his big return to DC, and for some reason, he is being welcomed back into the DC fold. Something brought him back. Some of that is this, I assume, is the creation of the Terrifics.
Yeah, and you would think that he's being given complete freedom to tell the story he wants to tell.
What we have been given to believe is that he's being given, like, an amazing amount of freedom.
Which, you know, which would be good. Because I'll be honest with you, Mr. Terrific, not really one of the premium characters in the DC
universe. Well, but no, I think Mr. Terrific has been a fascinating character. I mean, you had him, the great run that he had in Checkmate and a few other series. I mean, he is a character that should be taken seriously. And I think Dark Metal or Metal Dark or Batman Dark Metal, Dark Metal, Dark.
Metal Forge casting Metal Dark.
Right. Casting Forge Dark Metal. Like, there is an attempt to bring him back into relevance in the DC universe.
Yeah, and he has the run on the Arrowverse TV show.
Right.
Which, it's all right. Yeah, but I mean, and Phantom, I mean, well, okay, here's what I'm thinking. Mr. Terrific, I don't have really a lot to say about him. Phantom Girl, the only reason she's there is because she's invisible. She's invisible.
Right. Woman. She's the Wonder, or she's the Sue Storm.
Right. Metamorpho, honestly, know very little about this character.
Oh, Metamorpho's great.
Okay. You never Metamorpho you didn't like?
I.
Yeah, and then Plastic Man is Plastic Man. I mean, what can you say about Plastic Man?
Oh, well, I think you could say a lot about Plastic Man. I mean, that's a great character.
When the right writer, has a hold of him. Like, Grant Morrison did great things with Plastic Man.
Oh, well, and Kyle Baker did an amazing run with Plastic Man not so long ago, 5-10 years ago. That was kind of phenomenal.
Okay, if you say so.
Talking about a criminal, right? I mean, at the end of the day, Plastic Man is a criminal who was converted.
Okay. That's not uncommon in comic bookdom. I mean, hell, Hawkeye was a criminal. In fact, most of the Avengers were at one point a criminal.
That converted. Well, which him. Avengers run are you talking about? But no, I think the Terrifics is a really interesting concept, and I'm really interested because Marvel basically spent most of their career ripping off DC characters. And it is
that's a little bit harsh. That's a bit harsh.
Okay. Yeah. Because the Avengers are not the Justice League at all. And Moon Knight is not even remotely Batman.
Okay.
And Daredevil isn't remotely Batman.
But interesting things have done it. Look, nothing is original. You know, if once you get past
at some point something is original. Something had to be original before it wasn't.
No, it's all about, you know, I mean, you could say the DC's ripping off themselves, but, you know, Green Arrow is just Batman with a bow and arrow. It's Batman Robin Hood.
Yeah.
So they're taking there's certain premises.
Well, that's fine. And so what does that make Hawkeye, third generation?
You know what? The bow and arrow thing goes all the way back. Then you're saying, okay, well, they ripped off Robin Hood.
Sure. Why not?
You know, and Batman is just a ripoff of Shadow.
Well, I don't know about that.
They actually said that's where they got their inspiration from. Yeah, so...
But then what is Shadow a ripoff of? And what is Robin a ripoff of?
Exactly. So you can just keep going back and back and back and back. I mean, all the way... I mean, it goes back to the saying in philosophy that, you know, after Plato, there are no original ideas. So, but it's all about, you know, you can take a... like Moon Knight... They took a Batman type of character, but they did something really interesting with him, you know? So I find it really hard to get angry that, oh, they're ripping them off kind of a thing.
Well, nobody's angry.
Well, you sounded angry.
Ah!
Yeah. I mean, the Vision is the ripoff is derivative of Red Tornado, mm-hmm. But Vision's better.
Oh, which Vision?
The Vision, the definite article.
Well, I can't argue with that.
It's all about how the characters are, or what a writer, what a creator does with the character.
Right. Well, and which is why I think the Terrifics is a fascinating idea, is because Jeff Lemire is a creative individual. he has proven that over and over again, even though his runs on certain, particularly in Marvel, have not been that great. You see his independent work like Descender or Royal City.
Or Tooth Fairy.
Or Tooth Fairy, Sweet Tooth.
Sweet Tooth, whatever. I got to fix that in post.
You know, and the Keck can write some amazing stuff.
Yeah. So how much of his work at Marvel was him not living up to his own?
I think a lot of his work at Marvel was editorially dictated.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah. And I think some of his work at DC at the time that he was at DC previously was editorially dictated, which I think affected the end result. But you see with Lemire, when he is given free rein, he creates some really fascinating, interesting comics.
Yes, I agree. And I think, you know, the Terrifics, it's a great little...
Essex County also.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
That's I forgot to mention Essex County. I don't know. I mean,
it's brilliant.
I didn't want to leave that out.
So if the Terrifics is just, I mean, it's a fun joke, and it's a great middle finger to Marvel. But if that's all it is, then it's not going to be terrific. If they kind of get away with that. And actually make a good series, basically, don't lean on that is what I'm saying.
I think it all comes down to how much freedom he's given and how much that DC is going to allow him to just open up the concept, have some fun. I mean, they're good characters. Metamorpho is a fun character. Plastic Man is a very fun character. We'll see what they do with the other characters in it. But if it's, you know, if they go Doom Patrol on us, and by Doom Patrol, I don't mean replicating Doom Patrol, but if they go Doom Patrol on us, meaning like they just let the creator do whatever they want and kind of go crazy with stuff, it could be pretty great.
Pretty fantastic.
Pretty, well, I was avoiding saying pretty fantastic. I feel like I've done like way more fantastic references than I should have.
I think you've done at least four.
At least. It just, it sort of slips off the tongue, doesn't it? Terrific. So that's fantastic. I would say it at least four times. I think you already just said that.
Yeah, so the Terrifics is a way to torch Marvel with this new thing. With this new thing.
It's almost like Marvel's invisible in all of this.
Exactly.
I'm for it, and I am vastly curious to see what they do with it. If it sucks, well, it sucks, but at least they tried.
I just hope they do more than just troll Marvel. It's a great joke. But if they actually tell a really good story, then I'm on board as well. Let's move on to the next bit of news.
Okay.
The Doomsday Clock crossover. This is a crossover that will pit Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman with the likes of Dr. Manhattan, Ozymandias, and Rorschach of Watchmen. I don't have a lot of details on that. Do you know any more about it than...
Nope. We don't have any details.
Okay.
There's some black sites that think they know what's going to happen, but nobody really knows.
Well, first of all, I think it's Geoff Johns has announced that it's going to be released over Thanksgiving. And the reason for that is he remembered getting comics when he was a kid during Thanksgiving. And he had that whole extended time off to read all his comics.
I read that too. And you know what? I agree 100% on that.
I think it's a little.
I remember that.
Geoff Johns is just all, you know, he's just Mr. Nostalgia.
It is nostalgia, though. It is nostalgia. I mean, comics is nostalgia at this point. Let's be honest, most of the people, if anybody is listening to this, the vast majority of the people who are listening to this are of our age, and comics is nostalgia. It's we remember, this is why people bitch and moan about the current state of comics, is that it's not like I remember it. And you know what? And that's fine, but also comics kowtow to like the fan base that we are, who are complaining about, it's not like I remember it. And you know what? I remember buying comics every week. I used to buy them at the local Lawson's drugstore on a rack. And every week they'd put the new ones out and I'd get my comics and I'd get my stack comics. And you know what? Over Thanksgiving, those comics saved me from some god-awful family horseshit.
Well, I had the same thing growing up. Local drugstores down the road from me as well. Spinner racks in the back.
Yep.
and it's all well and fine. This is, you know, I love, we wouldn't be doing this show if we were not nostalgic about comics.
Right. Cause we're talking about old comics.
That's right. And it's nice to do an homage to the old things, but if you're writing comics specifically to appease the nostalgia of old farts who read comics, then you're not telling a good story.
Right.
Yeah. So
releasing something over like, you know, Thanksgiving weekend, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, to say like, this is a throwback to the idea of like, we want to give you an event comic before Thanksgiving weekend that you can sit and read.
And that's really nice.
That's a nice thing.
It is. But understand that when Jeff Johns and you and I were growing up, comic books took a longer time to read and you needed that extra time. How long does it take to read a modern comic?
It depends on the comic and who's writing it.
True.
If it's Bendis, then, you know, it takes you about 2 to 3 minutes to read one of his comics.
Yeah. As soon as you bought it, you've actually read it.
If it's a George Perez comic, then you have like 20 panels to a page, and it takes you an hour to read a comic illustrated by George Perez.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it depends on, you know, who you're talking about.
Yeah. No, I like Jeff Johns. I do feel that his one weakness is his penchant for nostalgia. That when he's trying to tell something new, he does a good job. But when he's leaning too heavily on what he wanted, what he thinks his kid self would like,
right,
that's when he falls into, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Telling a boring story, basically.
Well, I mean, but I think that's difficult, though, because who is the audience for? Okay, so you want to talk about Doomsday Clock.
Well, yeah.
And who is the audience for Doomsday Clock?
Well, this is actually, I didn't want to talk about Jeff Johns at all. I just, what I wanted to talk about.
If you want to talk about Doomsday Clock, you have to talk about Jeff Johns. He's writing it.
But the major thing that I'm interested in is the fact that do the Watchmen characters work in mainstream storylines? I mean, the whole point of Watchmen was to be a critique and a subversion of mainstream comics. And, see, I have no problem with Watchmen doing more Watchmen stories and keeping it within their own continuity. Mm-hmm. But to pull those characters out of that and then put it into your regular mainstream comic, doesn't that diminish what they were created to be?
No, not at all. Okay. Partly because the heresy of all of this is the fact that Alan Moore, regardless of what we think about him, and regardless of what we think about Watchmen, the original Watchmen, which I think is probably, I think Dave Gibbons does not get near enough credit for how great the Watchmen is.
Mm-hmm.
But the Watchmen was the Charlton comic stuff.
Yeah, well, that was what it was supposed to be.
Right. Alan Moore has, I don't believe in his entire career, created an original character. And that's fine. That's not what he does. But the idea that the Watchmen is sacrosanct in terms of like the creation or the creators behind it is kind of horsepucky.
That's not what I was trying to get at.
Right. Okay.
That's not what I'm trying to get at. What I mean is because, you know, Alan Moore originally did want to use the Charlton comics. When he couldn't, that allowed him to take analogs of those characters and then create what he created.
But they were blatant analogs.
Well, yes.
Which I have no problem with any of that. I think
Watchmen is
an amazing piece of work.
Yes. But... No, it was the deliberate copying of those characters in order to tell a deconstruction of modern comics. Sure. I mean, that was the whole point of it.
Right.
And the fact that you have these characters as analogs of existing characters or templates that you can just put over any major character. And the fact that they are a subversion, that they are a deconstruction of what a character should be. They don't work outside of that storyline to me. I don't think that they work outside the Watchmen storyline. If you try to pick a character, Rorschach or the Comedian, and try to put
Let's pick Rorschach because we all love Rorschach. He's our Batman and our Daredevil.
He was my favorite on Welcome Back, Cotter. by the way, for the
Ron
three...
Ron Paladino, I mean, where is he now?
Yes.
What the hell is his name? Ron Paladino?
I don't know. There's probably three people listening to this who got that reference.
Right, yeah.
But I just think that, you know, the Watchmen continuity should be the Watchmen continuity. To try to meld it into mainstream DC universe I think just diminishes what they were created to be.
But Alan Moore took the analogs and melded them in his universe. He took analogs from another universe, melded them into his universe.
But specifically,
so why is it suddenly?
Well, no. It's he did it specifically to make a point.
Well, but how do you? We don't even know what Geoff Johns' point is. I mean, it's. I don't care, to be honest, if Rorschach or any of the characters, the comedian, whoever, Dr. Manhattan, Ozymandias, you know, I don't really care if they show up in the DC universe. If they're used well.
And that's the thing. I don't think that they're going to be used well because I don't think that they can be used well.
Well, the whole
point of them is to diminish what superheroes are. That's the whole point, to lessen the impact of a superhero. So when you put these characters next to Batman and Superman, it takes the whole story down.
Right. So the cynical reading is, what you're saying is that the point of Watchmen is to lessen the superhero character.
Yes, to show the absurdity of it.
Okay. So why the hell are you still reading superhero comics?
Well, you can read
if the pinnacle of superhero comics is the Watchmen, whose whole point of, as you just said, is to diminish superhero comics, well then at that point that's when you stop reading superhero comics, because everything that we need to be said about superheroes has been said.
No. That's just one story, one critique, one take, you know, and it's an interesting storyline. It's an interesting take, but it is what it is. To move that, to try to shoehorn that into another type of story, it doesn't do justice to Watchmen, and it doesn't do justice to the story you're trying to shoehorn it into. It takes both of those things down a notch.
Just why?
Because those are characters that don't fit the mold. Maybe do something fantastic, but I don't see it happening.
So. Well, and maybe, like, I don't know. This could be a massive failure. Mm-hmm. I have no absolute feeling about whether this will be a success or a failure. But nobody has read it yet. We don't know what creators are going to actually be dealing with this outside of Geoff Johns. And we can have our own feelings about Geoff Johns. I respect Geoff Johns probably a little bit more than others. But at the same time, I also despise Bendis. so, I mean, we don't even know what the story is yet. And we're already talking about how it is not paying proper homage.
That's not it. That's not the point. That is not paying homage to Watchmen. It's not paying homage to Alan Moore. It's not saying that this thing is sacrosanct and we can't touch it. I'm saying that using these characters outside the story that they were intended to is going to be a bad story, because they're inherently, the way that they were created was not to tell stories outside of their continuity. They're created to tell stories within their own continuity. When you take them out of that continuity, they lose all impact.
So you feel that a thing should be static. Once it is created, it should not...
No.
Have a life.
No, I said that in the very beginning. I did not say.
Feel like that a character that any created thing cannot then be approached differently.
No, you're twisting this around. I said in the very beginning, I have no problem with new Watchmen stories being told in the Watchmen continuity.
Are you okay with Batman meeting the Question?
But why?
But he has. Renee Montoya was the Question.
I don't know much about that. I mean, but the Question wasn't created to be a deconstruction of comic books. He was created to be a comic book character. Do you understand the distinction I'm trying to make? They're the same genre, but they're two different subjects.
Right.
So, you know, right now, Batman and the Shadow are having a crossover event.
Yes.
Oh, and everybody thinks, oh, wow, that's great, because Batman was created from the Shadow and whatnot.
It sounds like fun. I'm not interested in the creators, so I haven't followed it. But
I'm not interested in the premise, in my mind. It's, you know, it's fine, and I suppose they'll work well together. But this whole melding of stuff, you know, Scooby-Doo and whoever Scooby-Doo's with now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Have you read the Martian, the Martian, or what was the
Martian Manhunter and
Martian Manhunter? Yeah, and the I mean, that's a hoot, right?
Okay, okay, I'll take your word for it.
Lobo versus the Roadrunner. Have you read that one yet?
No,
it's a lot of fun. Okay. Oh, and did you enjoy Batman meeting Elmer Fudd?
No,
you did not like that.
No,
you didn't like that comic.
No.
That was a great comic book. That was good comics.
Okay.
Did you read it?
It's
Tom King, Batman and Elmer Fudd?
It's fine. It's fine. It's a silly parody. It's fine for what it is. It's just a comedy thing. But that's not meant to be mainstream continuity. That's an Elseworld kind of a thing, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. Or it's just a one-off, isn't this, kind of fun? And that's fine for what it is, but they're not going to put Elmer Fudd into mainstream DC continuity.
But wouldn't it be great if they did?
No. See, that's a good point right there. Elmer Fudd was not created as a character to be in a superhero in the DC universe.
Man, that's a really, that's just a really conservative reading of open stuff up. It's comics. We're not talking we're not talking about real world here.
No, I'm talking about
this is like comics. The whole point of comics.
I'm talking about telling a good story.
Like absolutely, mm-hmm. Do anything that can't possibly be possible, and just throw it out there and do the craziest, wackiest, insane stuff possible. Yes, we have serious comics. The comic we're talking about.
You're missing my point. You're missing my point completely. I'm talking about telling a good story, and yes, you can do crazy, outlandish things. But when you go too far afield and you try to mix two situations that don't work well together, you end up telling a really bad story.
Tell a bad story, but what if someone can tell a good story?
What I'm trying to say
is... Are you saying it's impossible for someone to tell a good story?
You have to be really, really good at mixing genres like that, and I don't think Geoff Johns is that good.
But we don't know yet.
We can get back to this in an episode or two when the first...
When the first issue hits in November.
Yeah.
I have a feeling we're going to be talking about this again in November.
No doubt.
And you may be right. You may absolutely be right. We may read that first issue and be like, oh, this is terrible. Or we may read the first issue and say like, well, I don't know how I feel about this. But DC already suffered through the fanboy, fanboy rampage when they did the Before Watchmen. I'm not trying to get into Before Watchmen right now, because that's a whole nother discussion. We could go hours on that.
And that's and that actually speaks to my point. I wasn't one of those fanboys that went crazy that they were creating new stories in the Watchmen continuity. I was all for that. Fine. Tell as many stories as you want in that universe.
Well,
but that universe is created to tell a certain type of story.
Right. I want to see where it goes from here, because it's a planned 12-issue series in which things are going to happen in a sequential nature. And so what we read in the first issue
may
not carry through. We don't know. The way it's being set up right now and the way they're slowly introducing this stuff in there, we don't know how they're going to introduce the Watchmen characters into the DC universe. We don't know if it's going to be a long-term thing or if it's just going to be a way to explain some other things and then it goes away. We don't know. We just don't know.
Okay. So basically, to sum up, I think you're taking my point to an extreme that was not meant to be. I'm just saying that to try to shoehorn in characters that weren't created to be in a mainstream continuity is just going to do a disservice to those characters, and it's going to do a disservice to the mainstream continuity. And ultimately, I think storylines will suffer. That's my opinion.
Right. And to sum up for my point is, I'm like, well, why the hell not? That was an easy sum up, right? My summary is, why the hell not?
Hey, Brian, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Scout.
All right.
Hey there. Do you like Man Thing? You know I do. In fact, there is nothing I like more than getting my hands on a giant-sized Man-Thing. It just makes me feel so good. Wait, you know I'm talking about the comic book character, right? Of course you do. How could you be thinking anything else? Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you too can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre. Oh, and I'll probably make some penis jokes.
And we're back. This week on the episode, we'll be talking about the acclaimed Vertigo series Scalped by Jason Aaron and R.M. Guerra. Brian, this is your recommendation, so take it away.
Okay, so here's my prepared statement. Scalped is a 60-issue series for Vertigo written by Jason Aaron and illustrated by R.M. Guerra that ran from 2007 to 2012. The series focuses on the Oglala Lakota inhabitants of the fictional Prairie Rose Indian Reservation in modern-day South Dakota as they grapple with organized crime, rampant poverty, drug addiction and alcoholism, local politics, and the preservation of their cultural identity. Today we'll be discussing the first 11 issues, which comprises 3 story arcs, Indian Country, Hokahe, and Casino Boogie. The primary characters in these arcs are Chief Lincoln, Red Crow, Dashiell Badhorse, Gina Badhorse, Catcher, FBI agent Bayless Earl Nitz, Dina Poorbear, and Carol Redcrow. The series is episodic in nature, with many flashbacks and time jumps, and is essentially a sprawling crime drama with hard-boiled language and many scenes of extreme violence brilliantly rendered by R.M. Guerra. The setup begins with Dashiell Badhorse, son of Gina Badhorse, returning to the reservation after 15 years and quickly ingraining himself into the suspicious graces of Lincoln Redcrow, president of the Oglala Tribal Council and chief architect of the soon-to-open Crazy Horse Casino. Dash is assigned to the tribal police force and cements his reputation as a badass through a series of raids on meth labs and other sundry bad actors. In reality, Bad Horse is an undercover FBI agent overseen by Agent Bayless Earl Nitz and ordered to find evidence linking Red Crow to the murder of 2 FBI agents 30 years ago during Red Crow's time as a member of a Native American rights organization co-run with Dashiell's estranged mother, Gina Badhorse. The Hokahe arc explores the relationship between Gina and Red Crow via a combination of flashbacks and in real time. We see the aftermath in 1975 of the murder of 2 FBI agents by the Dog Soldiers, which includes Catcher, Gina Badhorse, and Lincoln Redcrow. And we see the events that follow, leading to Lawrence Belcourt, a clear Leonard Peltier stand-in, being charged for the murder. At the end, Gina's body is shown scalped and abandoned in the wilderness. The term Hokahe is used by Catcher as a toast to said Dog Soldiers. Oh, and Dash and Carol Redcrow, Lincoln's daughter, they have sex. Lots of it. The final arc, Casino Boogie, focuses on 6 distinct characters that are important to the overriding story, their histories, and a hint towards their motivations. We learn of Dino Poorbear's desire to escape the reservation and the culture that holds him back. Gina Badhorse has a long conversation with Lawrence Belcourt in prison. We get the origin of Lincoln Redcrow and come to understand the horrors that provoke him towards committing further horrors. We learn about Diesel and the identity politics that motivated him. And we see the interaction between Granny Poorbear and Catcher with the inherent mysticism that exists between them and their interpretation of what that portends. Finally, Dino Poorbear and his friends discover Gina Badhorse's dead body. And that is what we have in the first 11 issues.
Okay. That is a lot of ground to cover.
Well, I think the biggest problem in trying to cover, and it is my fault where I suggested we do 11 issues as opposed to a more succinct 5 to 6 issues on this, is that I felt like these 11 issues are sort of a piece of a whole. And I didn't feel like you could do like the first few issues or like a middle period. I felt like these first 11 issues were all of a piece.
Yes, and I agree with that. They all seem to fit together really, really well. And it tells, if you were just to tell, say, the first 6 issues, it sets up the world, but you don't really get a feel for who these characters are and who these people are.
Exactly. And I feel like besides the like sort of intense violence, like this series is very violent.
Oh, yes.
It's extremely violent. And not just the violence, but just the idea of human life as expendable is very prevalent throughout the entire series and is very strongly communicated in these first 11 issues.
Well, yes, and that follows from these people have been pushed aside. They've been put on a reservation, literally just, you know, thrown away.
And we're talking about Native Americans.
Native Americans. So by their very, where they live, by their nature, they are told that they are lesser, that
right.
they won't amount to anything. And when you're told that your life is worthless, there is no respect for life.
Right. And it sets the stage for the series and sort of it's a very nihilistic series from start to finish. Not just these 11 issues, but the entire 60-issue run is a sense of nihilism that permeates.
Well, it's a sense of hopelessness,
mm-hmm.
that there's no way out of a situation.
Well, and you look at Dino Poorbear, one of the great characters in this, and there's that whole issue where he is trying to get out, and you see the fact that he is living in this intense poverty. He has a child that he is willing to abandon if he can just get the right car and he can just get the right amount of money and he can leave. But in his arc, he gets the money. He gets it from Lincoln Redcrow, who takes pity on him.
Yes. So, and yet
he doesn't leave.
Yes. Because I think that this story, the entire story of Scalped in general, tells this in various different ways. But this cycle of violence and poverty and hopelessness, the cycle of abuse, keeps people trapped in dangerous self-defeating patterns and lifestyles. And even when presented with a way out, they don't take that chance because hopelessness in and of itself becomes a form of addiction.
Right. Well, we see that even in Lincoln Redcrow, who has built himself up into this, he's basically a mob boss. I mean, the whole series is basically, it's Sopranos, right?
Yes.
I mean, at the end of the day, Scalped is a crime saga.
Yes.
It's a crime saga that is just happens to be set in a reservation as opposed to like in New Jersey.
It should be said that the way that it's crafted, the way that it's... The way the art is created, its visual look, it's very noir. It's a very gangster noir film. It even has, you know, characters who are outsiders and femme fatales, right. and gangsters.
Right.
You know, so it is very...
Guerrera for the art.
Oh, absolutely.
The art is fantastic in terms of Guerrera creates this sort of... There's a lot of... It's a lot of browns and sort of earth tones.
Yeah, browns and yellows and dark shadows.
And the expressiveness that he gives each face, which is very unique.
Yes. And I don't know, who is the colorist for this series? Because the color is so vibrant and it's earth and muted, but it shines in parts. And it was
Lee Luffridge did the coloring and also Gio Labrusco.
The mood that it creates, it gives you the idea of the desert barrenness. But still, it pops when it needs to. It's really stunning to work at. Stylized as hell.
Well, and you feel the hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
But you also see, you know, in Lincoln Redcrow, who is set up as the villain, right? I mean, it establishes a villain, but in Lincoln Redcrow, it's like his whole point is like when he creates this casino, the casino is bright, right? I mean, it is bright and is clean.
And it's artificial.
And it's artificial.
Yeah. And he tries to tell himself, this is the tragedy of this character, is that he's trying to tell himself that he's doing this for the betterment of his people. When in reality, it's just a selfish, he's doing it for the betterment of self.
Well, we're led to believe that.
Yes.
But I think what is also fascinating about this is the complexity of every character, including Lincoln Redcrow.
Mm-hmm.
Including Dash. I mean, the series basically establishes Dash as the protagonist, and he has to be one of the stranger protagonists because he's a piece of shit.
Yes. Well, he comes out of this he comes out of this hopelessness. He's still trapped there, even though he's gotten out. He
was rejected by his mother at an early age. Like, we see this in the comic where she at 6 years old, she sends him away. Yes. She sends him away from this world. But she has demons, so she's protecting him from this, we think.
In a sense, but every single character, even when they outwardly profess to be acting altruistically, they're really acting in their own self-interest. His mother just didn't need her kid around. And yes, she's trying to do it to, you know, quote-unquote protect him. But really, if you get down deep into it, she just wanted him gone.
Well, yeah. I mean, remember, she was also dealing with the fact that she was involved in the murder of two FBI agents.
Yes. I mean,
and this
don't get me wrong.
Just right after that, this arc that we're reading doesn't actually explain who his father was. And we get to that later.
Well, we should, you know, we're focusing just on these 11 issues.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, every character in this story is incredibly complex. No one is by the numbers.
Right.
Everyone's motivations are multifaceted, but the theme of selfishness, of self-interest, mm-hmm. continues. And it's, and whether you're doing that in prostitution or guns, or even Gina's attempts to shut down the casino. What is she really doing that for? What are her motivations?
Well, one would assume it's preservation of the Native American culture. I mean, she and the others who are working with her are actively opposing the building of the Crazy Horse Casino.
But she has created her own, she has created the persona of who she is around this, just being opposed to things. You know what I mean? Because you see that her history throughout in flashback, and it's just one thing after another. I'm not saying that she's wrong, but she has built up her sense of self through protest, to the point where she cannot even connect with her child.
Well, I mean, that's the question. Was she protecting Dash, or was she getting him out of the way?
It's very, this is a very deep comic.
Yeah. I mean, even in the 11 issues where it's basically just intro, we're already dealing with a shit ton of ideas. And I think this is where Jason Aaron, like, really... This is why this is considered one of Jason Aaron's, like, most important pieces of work, is because he's building a world where there is no black and white.
Exactly.
Where everyone is compromised. Dash is compromised as a FBI agent who is a reluctant FBI agent.
Well, he used the FBI as a way to get out of this reservation, and then the FBI... Again, selfishness and self-interest.
Turned around and sent him back.
Turns around and throws him back. So everyone, yep. even the FBI agents, are all doing this for their own self-interest.
And Agent Nitz is a piece of shit.
Yes, he is.
Dash's handler, Agent Nitz, is a piece of shit who has revenge on his mind because of the death of the two FBI agents in 1975. And we're talking like 20, 30 years later. He's still, the reason he has sent Dash there is to try to catch Red Crow.
Right. Because he has.
Kind of compromising position.
Yeah. He has his own self-interest at heart. His own selfish reasons. And it's stunning. The way that these individual selfishness, all this individual selfishness all intertwines with each other. And that's where the real conflict comes from, is that everyone's trying to do what they want.
Right.
And that always butts up against someone else's selfish needs as well. It's incredibly complex.
It's almost too much to take on in one podcast, but,
Well, I can tell you right now, there's so much we're going to be leaving out.
Yeah. I mean, and we have to, just based on time and, you know, people's attention. But I want to go back to where you say everyone is selfish.
Yeah.
And I want to draw attention to Granny Poor Bear, where I feel like, at least in the initial 11 issues, now we also know that a lot of things happen going forward.
Yeah.
That change perceptions, but you have the whole Granny Poor Bear, who is the, for lack of a better word, I refer to Granny Poor Bear and Catcher, who is also a person of questionable intent.
Excellent.
Yeah, but Granny Poor Bear and Catcher, are basically presented in this early stage as sort of the generic magic Negro.
Yes. Catcher more reluctantly, so.
Right, and yeah. Right. But you know what I mean? It's like, it's that sort of Caucasian application of that which is different and is somehow mystical is then suddenly elevated into, you know, the magic Negro. I mean, Field of Dreams and, you know, insert whatever else, whatever show you want to do where
we create
the other as a mystical force.
I just want to, as an aside, I do want to throw out there that there are critics of this book that say it perpetuates negative stereotypes.
Right.
And they condemn people who praise it as, you know, part of the problem. But I, and again, this is difficult coming from a, you know, middle-aged white man, but I don't see it as a perpetuation of stereotypes. It is a crime drama that focuses on crime. And you can see from Jason Aaron's other work, like Southern Bastards and even his run on Thor, he has deliberately invoked stereotypes in order to consciously subvert it.
Yes.
So in many of these, you know, stereotypes, he's doing it deliberately to make a point. I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, sure. And we know that is where he is now. The question is, where was he then? And I tend to agree with you in terms of, I don't think he intentionally created the magic. It's hard to say the magic Negro sort of concept of the, you know, the Native American as a spiritual shaman. Yeah. But he does introduce Catcher and Granny Poor Bear as basically shamans.
Yeah. Now, okay, so this is Catcher. Are we to believe, just from these 11 issues, are we to believe that he is legitimately having these visions? Or is it a product of the alcohol, the drugs?
Or is it both?
Oh, there is both too. Because this is a world that is just gritty realism.
Right.
And then we throw on the mystical element on top of it.
We have to, like, we can't state more strongly, like, how violent this series is. I mean, there are long panels of just extensive violence.
Yes. Even the sex is violent.
Yeah.
I mean, and deliberately so. It's right. Again, trying to, you know, to really strike home the point that this is not a pleasant place to be. But the mystical side of things, that always, it threatened to take me out of the story because it is so grounded. It is so, for lack of a better term, gritty, realistic, grimdark.
Right.
Yeah. But then we have these mystical visions. And I just thought that seemed a bit out of place, unless, of course, you see them as Catcher's response to his addiction.
But what is weird is that Catcher, you know, because essentially with Catcher, he's seen the spirit animal, and that is actually, you know, a thing. And the fact that it is also posited within these issues that Catcher is he was a Rhodes Scholar, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like,
it's established that he was a Rhodes Scholar and a genius who then was taken in by the Dog Soldiers, i.e. Gina Bad Horse, Lincoln Red Crow, and some other characters who haven't been introduced yet, but will be later. So we're not talking about a character who is given to
flights of fancy.
Exactly. Flights of fancy. So what he has seen, like, he's a severe alcoholic. And by the way, a complete shout out to Festus the Horse. To me, Festus the Horse is my favorite character in the entire series. Festus the horse, to those who haven't read this yet, is Catcher's horse.
Yeah.
It's this poor horse that Catcher rides everywhere.
So you believe that that Catcher is truly seeing these things, that he's really,
I think he is.
Okay. See, I read it as he's seeing these things because he intellectually believes that he can, and the alcoholism and the drugs are sort of, he's hallucinating basically, but he's smart enough to know that these particular animals and these particular legends are associated with these people. So,
well,
it's hallucination based on his own intellect. If that makes sense.
He could be projecting, but what is projecting? You know, the idea is projecting a spiritual thing or is it an intellectual thing?
It's all about interpretation. I think that he's seeing these things because he expects to see them, if that makes sense.
Sure. But why is he expecting to see them?
Because it's his intellect, which he interprets through his spirituality. But Catcher is a very tragic figure, to be sure.
Well, he's not yet.
Well, even in these issues, he's a reluctant shaman.
He's a very reluctant shaman. And the scene where he meets Dash in the bathroom in the casino is a very telling moment. Because he doesn't want to be there.
Right.
Dash doesn't want to be there. Dash is like, what the hell?
Well, that whole... We should talk about the back half of this series of the issues we're reading are all told out of joint from a different point of view. So things that happen, and rereading this, I had forgotten about how incredible this was crafted. Where things happen and events are talked about that haven't happened yet. That happened two or three issues down the line when they're told in flashback of a different.
Oh yeah, it's very frustrating. Like I read this like originally. In the single issue run.
Right. And
my God, I had to go back to each previous issue because they jump all over the place.
I know. I found that just incredibly fascinating. I love the disjointed storytelling. The fact that like the payoff of the bus being stolen.
the Merle Haggard bus.
Yes. So in early on you just get a phone call of Merle Haggard's bus has been stolen and you just think that's a throwaway line. And then two issues later you find out that it's Dash who has stolen the bus in order to chase a criminal.
But it's not even clearly identified. It's just they just show him riding with the bus, and you just see on the bus it just says Merle Haggard.
Yes, and it's brilliant. It's like just reading this.
They don't explain it to you at all. They're just like, you figure it out yourself.
Yeah, it's really quite well done. Can I tell you, okay, is it wrong of me? All the violence that's in this story and all the terrible things that are happening, the one thing that I'm most upset about are the dogs being killed.
Well, that's a major thing because that's so to people who haven't read this yet, Lincoln Red Crow's office at the casino is invaded. And to make a point by those who have invaded his casino, Lincoln Red Crow is the sort of the Tony Soprano of all of this. Lincoln Red Crow he's the guy that has established the casino. He's the guy that was behind the building of the casino. He is the guy that is behind the tribal council. And he's the Tony Soprano. Sorry to repeat myself, but...
Now, he's the mob boss. Yeah, you're right.
He's the mob boss. But at some point, his office is invaded. And to make a point, those who have invaded his office has killed his two dogs.
And it was awful.
And it's actually like a major point in the comic.
Well, it's a metaphor of how the innocent get in the way.
The two dogs are in his office now. To be honest, like we saw earlier on, the dogs also ate a human being.
They did. Oh yeah, but yeah. That's not the dog's fault. They weren't.
Well,
they weren't born that way.
Right, but remember, this is the level of violence that's in the comic.
Yeah. Okay, so the dogs weren't exactly innocent.
And Red Crow fed it was Red Crow that fed the body to them.
But still, man, don't kill the dog. What's wrong with you?
Well, you're a dog lover. I mean, it's brutal. Brutal when the dogs eat the person. It's brutal when someone kills the dogs.
Yes. But what I was saying about how, you know, you see this, the people on the reservation, because the people of the reservation are sort of all the main characters. This gets back to the selfishness thing, I guess. Mm-hmm. They all have their own agenda, and they all say that they're working for these people, for the betterment of the reservation. But in fact, they're sort of throwaway. They're, you know, the casino doesn't really help the people. It helps the people who own the casino.
It helps Red Crow. Yeah. And his cronies, who are mentioned briefly, the Hmong, which we see later on in the series. But, you know, Red Crow is actually in Hawk to another group that's going to come into play later.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not just that. I mean, even if you look at the extreme alcohol and drug addiction or just the way that the people of the reservation, the commoners, if you want to call them that, are used. They're just given bread and circuses.
Right.
They're used as pawns, as a means to an end. And whether it's the government or the FBI or the mob or the tribal council, everyone is attempting to enrich themselves, to get what they want, all couching it in a way that seems to imply that they are just trying to help. But the fact is, they just want the normal person's support as the best way to get what they themselves want. And everything that they do, whether it's drugs or the casino, it's just a way to placate the people.
Well, I mean, the whole series focuses on the extremism. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Guerrera does a great job, like artistically, of presenting, you know, the random inhabitants of the reservation. Like you see that over and over again, you know, the ones who are just like, fuck it.
Yeah. Well, Dino's essentially like that. And you get that in his point of view story, you get a lot of that just despair of what life on the reservation is.
And he's given every opportunity to escape.
But that's what addiction is.
And won't do it. And he's not addicted. He's not a drug addict. He's not an alcoholic. He's addicted to something in the reservation that he can't leave.
Exactly. Exactly. It's hard to break out of patterns. Even if they're self-destructive patterns, it's almost impossible to get away from. Even if you know it's the right thing to do, you know that it's that itself is a form of addiction. It's very sad. Ultimately, this story is a crime drama,
right?
With like I said, it's a noir film with Western tropes,
right?
And you know, it can't be stated enough. The artwork is truly stunning, even in the gruesome violence and gratuitous sex, it is still stunning to look at.
Right. Well, it's, yeah. But, and then Jason Aaron's writing, I mean, his dialogue, it's just, his setup of themes is...
It's masterful in how he sets up his storytelling technique. He's throwing out future storylines that you don't even know it's several issues down the line when a plot point that he started in the very beginning comes back. It's really well crafted.
Right. Well, and you're dealing with, like, you know, the piece of shit that is the FBI and how the FBI is trying to manipulate Dash, and also we find out later Diesel, into, you know, trying to take down this reservation. And we find out that the reason for that is that Nitz was friends with one of the two FBI agents who were killed in 1975, right?
So he has his own motivations.
He has his own motivation. It's not noble. His motivation is not noble. He's not trying to save anybody. He's trying to get Nitz, Agent Nitz, the FBI agent Nitz, is trying to, like, get revenge. That's his whole point.
Well, is anyone noble in this story? Even when you talk about the casino, which purportedly is to, you know, raise money for the reservation so that everybody's standard of living comes up. But they might talk about the betterment of the people. I guess Red Crow, he talks about the betterment of people, but he's just as bad as the organizations he claims to despise.
I think exactly. And I think this is the horrors that Red Crow's experienced in his life, he is revisiting on others.
But he is in the cyclical nature of this violence, he is becoming just like the oppressors.
Right.
He is becoming...
You become that which you hate the most.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that there, as much hopelessness as they've assigned, as Aaron has assigned to this series, I do think that there are characters who have a redeemable quality.
Well, everyone's compelling.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, you like all the characters. You like Dashiell. I love the fact that it's Dashiell.
Yeah.
You know, it's a nice throwback to Dashiell Hammett.
Yeah, and a nice little nod to the noir setting.
Right.
Rereading these issues, I had forgotten just how cinematic it's structured. Very deliberately episodic. Why this hasn't been made into a television series, I don't know.
I think they're planning on doing that.
I had not.
Although that's been talked about for years.
Don't you think this would be much better than, say, the Confederate story?
Oh, geez. That's just bad. No. At this point, leave that alone. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, put the Game of Thrones cats on Scalped.
Yeah, how cool would that be?
Yeah, I mean, because when you say cinematic, I mean it is. It's just like,
well, the heavy, the harsh shadows and the dramatic lighting, the way the scenes are set. I could see this on a giant screen, you know, playing out. It's really. I can't say how masterfully crafted this is. I can't express that enough. But I ultimately, obviously, we both really enjoyed this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's incredibly important and something that everyone should read, even if you disagree with the premise. It's still worthwhile. We're only scratching the surface. There's so much here, so many themes, so many underlying ideas. Just the motivations of the characters alone. We could talk for another hour just on each character's motivation. This could be two or three more episodes.
Yeah,
but I think we need to.
We need to close it out
and come to a close. I think we just did it right there.
Okay.
So thank you, Brian, for recommending this. This was actually I loved going back and rereading this. I read it when it was first released, in trade, I should say. And I loved it then, and I found so much more to it this second time around.
Well, and I think it's one of the most important pieces of work that we've had in the last 20 years.
I agree. I think it's incredibly relevant, and it has a lot to say about the world we live in. I think everyone should pick up a copy and read not just these first 11, but the entire series all the way through.
Absolutely.
So, Brian, next time, do you want to know what you're going to have to read?
I would like to know what I have to read, Paul Carr.
For next episode, we are going to do Ultimate Comics Spider-Man Volume 2, Scorpion. It collects issues 6 through 10 of Ultimate Spider-Man. Do you know who that's written by?
Is it by any chance written by Stan Lee?
No, but you actually are dragging out this answer.
Is it written by...
In the same way that the writer does as well.
Jerry Conway?
It is not written by Jerry Conway.
Chris Claremont.
No. In fact, Chris Claremont would be the exact opposite of this guy.
Oh, gee whiz, Paul. I don't know.
It's Mr. Brian Bendis.
Bendis!
You knew you'd have to read Bendis at some
Bendis!
Point.
Bendis!
I actually am, as far as the Ultimate Universe is concerned, I was never really impressed with Ultimate Comics. I like the idea of it more than I actually like the comics that were produced for it, with the exception of this run of Spider-Man by Brian Bendis. Not just Miles Morales, but all of his Peter Parker run and all of Miles Morales as well. I think this is incredibly, incredibly well done and good storytelling. And I know that you haven't read any Miles Morales.
I have not.
So this is actually the second arc of Miles Morales, but it's really where things start to take off and really good storytelling. So I think you're going to enjoy it.
Well, I better. Or else.
All right, Brian. This brings to a close this episode of the Collected Edition. Thank you, Brian. I really had a good time talking about this.
Thank you, Paul.
So until next time.
We'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks' time, we will see you then. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the hashtag Collected Edition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Okay, just found something from the San Diego Comic-Con. Doomsday Clock will be a countdown to the future of the universe. The next big change in the DCU will be a year in the telling and reset the universe. That's from San Diego.
They're resetting the universe. That's fine. But they're not saying, like, it's not a reboot.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'll meet you in Semantics Town right across the way. Yeah, we'll
see. Wasting away in Semantics Town.
Yeah. By the way, one of the worst comic book characters ever, Mr. Semantics. Why don't you save that person? Well, I can't really save them. So it's Mr. Semantics, Captain Semantics, and his...
I think Captain Semantics is the best.
Captain Semantics and his alter ego is E.B. White.
Oh, wow.
There you go, deep cut.